The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week,
we use the tools of science every day in the laboratory to try to figure out what's going on around us and what this is all about. But at some point, the toolbox runs out and there remain lots of bigger questions. And I think that's where literature picks up.
Already lauded for his work in neuroscience and as a fiction writer, David Eagleman has now inspired an opera of his book about the afterlife, Some. He discusses the delicate balance between art and science and how to get it just right. And?
Well, what are the numbers behind things like women's vulnerability to HIV and how do we understand that more? And then how do we design and test interventions to actually do something about it?
Mathematician Charlotte Watts talks about how to collect and use data as an unexpected way to tackle the problem of violence against women around the world. Plus, the UK's House of Lords is due for reform to make it more democratic. But does that risk losing all of its scientific expertise in the process? The Campaign for Science and Engineering is worried that it might. We'll hear more from Assistant Director of the group, Beck Smith. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. David Eagleman is one of those trendy young neuroscientists whom we have a lot of time for on this programme. He's been here before to talk about his book Incognito, which addressed the question of why our brains don't allow us to know what's going on inside them and whether prejudices are hardwired. David was in London recently, not to talk more about brains, but rather to expand his oeuvre as an author of fiction. The Royal Opera House staged a musical interpretation of his thoughtful book, Some, a series of short stories about what life after death might look like. Guardian science correspondent Ian Sample met David to hear about Some, the opera. And, well, he couldn't not ask him about his recent work on the brain as well.
I'm David Eagleman. I'm a neuroscientist at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston. I've written a book of literary fiction called Some, and it's 40 short stories, and all 40 stories are mutually exclusive, and they all take place in different possible afterlives, and it's not actually really about the afterlives. It's about the joys and complexities of being human. It's an interesting backdrop against which to explore what matters to us and what our lives are made out of.
So as a scientist, you're coming to something that a lot of scientists would normally shy away from, issues of the afterlife and things like that. What was the appeal there?
Well, the key is that we use the tools of science every day in the laboratory to try to figure out what's going on around us and what this is all about. But at some point, the toolbox runs out and there remain lots of bigger questions like what is life about and what are we doing here and so on. And I think that's where literature picks up. It's getting at the same issues. It's just a different way of asking the questions. So I've always, in parallel to my science career, I've always been a writer. And Some was a way of exploring these very human issues that there is no way to apply science to.
So you're in London now because that book has been turned into a chamber opera. That book came out in 2009. Take us through what happened on opening night. What was that like?
Well, actually, I'll step back before opening night. What happened is I was caught. Here's what happened. The Royal Opera House commissioned a very talented composer named Max Richter to write a new opera. And so he and Wayne McGregor, who's a very talented choreographer, director there at the Royal Opera House, they talked for a while about what they were going to make for an opera. And it turns out that one of them called the other and said, "Look, I just read this book, Some. This is what we should do." And the other one said, "I was just about to call you and tell you the same thing." So then I got a call, and they said, "We'd like to turn your book into an opera." So I said yes, and we talked about it. And the process was interesting. My schedule has been such that I made a conscious decision not to get involved in all the work, the production, the putting together of it, and you know, just having it in the ultimately capable hands of Max Richter and Wayne McGregor was the greatest move, because I went to opening night last week and it was such an incredible experience. They took 16 of the 40 stories and left the text exactly as is. So the text is exactly as it's written in the book. And there are these extremely talented singers singing this. Unlike many modern operas, which are dissonant, the music here is gorgeous. It's beautiful music. There's lights. It's sort of interactive in the sense that the singers are in the audience and they're walking around the audience with you. So it's all very intimate. And I just found the experience mind-blowing because it was as though I had drawn a two-dimensional picture that I'd worked on very hard. And then some Pixar animator had come along and turned into the third dimension. That's what I felt like, is that someone had taken what I'd written and pulled out this whole new dimension. So that was my experience at opening night.
What are you thinking when the phone goes and you have these, you hear this story of these two pretty idiosyncratic artists saying, "We read your book, we really like it, we want to turn it into an opera"? What goes through your mind?
You know, happily, I've been down this road several times with this book. In 2009, Brian Eno contacted me to say that he wanted to make a musical production of some. And we did that at the Sydney Opera House in 2009. And then the next year, we did a reprise of it in Brighton. And it's such a terrific experience for an artist to write something, to bring something into the world, and then have other people add to it and make something new out of it. It's I imagine the same sort of experience of having a child and then the child goes off to college and creates something new. And the child belongs to you, but in some sense, he also now belongs to the greater world. So it's a terrific experience. I've really been so lucky with this book, some, that it's inspired several things. There are various companies who are interested in the film rights to it. It looks like in the States it's going to be made into a theater production, although it's unclear exactly what that's going to look like. But all these various, it has its own 40 afterlives.
You called it an asynchronous meeting of minds. You meeting these two guys. What did you mean by that?
Well,
do you work that differently, or
the reason it was asynchronous is because I wrote some over 7 years, and in some sense, I bottled up all the best ideas that I had over that period of time, and then compressed them down into this book. That's the experience for the reader: is you're in one world, you flip the page, and you're in a totally different universe now, and so on. So that was my compressing all those 7 years of ideas down into a very short thing. But the interesting part is it retains the bubbles so that when somebody opens the book for the first time years later, it's fresh for them, which is really neat for me as an author because I'm so inured to these stories now. But for other people, when they open it, it's still a fresh experience. So that's the sense in which it was asynchronous, because I wrote the book, Max and Wayne discovered it years later, they worked on it, and now there's this new thing that's come out of it. But all the pieces have happened several years apart.
One of the other things you do, very far away from Sam, was his work on neurolaw, aspects of neurolaw. And before this interview, we put out a few tweets asking if anyone had any questions for you. And you've had some come in on aspects of neurolaw. It'd be good to run them past you. A guy called Pete Etchells got in touch and asked that if judges aren't experts in neuroscience, how easy is it for them to abuse the system when presenting imaging evidence? I think what he probably means is how easy is it for that system to be abused rather than the judges themselves abusing it. But that's, I think you get his point.
It's a very important question. Happily, in courts of law, this is well worked out. So there are standards for introducing new technologies into court. So you can't just come into, I can't come into the court and say, "Hey, I've invented the Brain Eagle 3000, which can read your thoughts and tell you whether there was a murderer here or not." I mean, I can try, but there are very standard ways of whether the judge will accept the new technology. And this has to do with things like, is it accepted by the rest of the community? Is it well published? Does it apply not only to lab settings, but in real world settings and so on? And so what's happened in the United States is that several people have tried to introduce neuroimaging evidence, and so far it hasn't actually been accepted in the courtrooms. And I think that's appropriate because at the moment, there isn't a lot you can say on an individual basis using neuroimaging. You can say very, very good things on group level, like, okay, if we measure 50 psychopathic brains here and 50 control brains here, you can measure these differences. But it's hard to say anything about an individual difference. That's point number one. Point number two is there's a lot of misunderstanding about how neuroimaging even could be used in courtrooms. So I direct the initiative on neuroscience and the law, and I get calls at least once a week from defense lawyers who say, hey, look, I've got a client who's up for murder, and will you do a brain scan and find something wrong with his brain so we can go to the jury and use it as mitigating evidence? So I always tell them no, and I tell them, I'll give you a piece of free advice, which is you've totally misunderstood what this sort of evidence can do for your client. If you prove to the jury that there's something wrong with your client's brain, then they'll say, oh, okay, great, let's fry him for sure. It's not mitigating, it's exacerbating, because what you've just done is proven to the jury that there's reason to expect that your client will continue to commit crimes into the future. So I hope the legal community gets this part straight pretty soon. Some people, when they first hear about neuro law, they think that it's going to translate into something like diminished responsibility and letting people off the hook, and it's not that at all. There are many brain problems that will cause people to be locked up for a longer time. The hope is that what we'll get is a more refined legal system so that where we can help people by rehabilitation or in some cases with lesser sentencing, then we do that. In cases where people need to be locked away for longer, then we do that. But the idea is that we can treat things on a case-by-case, forward-looking, evidentiary basis rather than just operating off provably bad intuition.
You might have answered this second question that came in, but it's slightly different. Comes in from a guy called Jim P. And he asks, are we moving towards treatment and sentences tailor-made for criminals based on their individual neuroscience?
Perfect. That's exactly where we're moving. And what's nice, I've been speaking on the subject a lot in the United States and in other places in the world too. And I'm starting to see slowly some changes, maybe not based on the talks I've been giving to judges and policymakers, but instead just based on the economy. And the change in particular is, instead of having a single court system, what a lot of jurisdictions are doing is they're peeling off a separate mental health court, they're peeling off a separate drug court, a separate juvenile court. And what you have in each of these is expertise. You have judges who get it. They know what schizophrenia is. They know what different mental illnesses are. They get drugs. They get how juvenile brains are different from adult brains. And this is a very important first step towards that individualization. It's not all the way, but it's really moving in the right direction. So I'm very pleased to see that. And I think that really is the future of this.
David, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks to David Eagleman there. To keep up to speed with David's works of science and art, go to his website, davideagleman.com. Scientists who contribute outside their fields to literature or contemporary opera, in the case of David Eagleman, are undoubtedly doing very good things for all our souls. But while those contributions might be an added extra, there's a field where more scientists really do need to start getting involved and pronto. Politics. Legislators not only decide which bits of the scientific endeavour to fund, they also need advice and sense-checking in almost every aspect of policymaking. We've argued many times before about the value of scientists taking up seats in both houses of parliament. Quite simply, it's crucial to enabling and testing legislation. But at a time when scientific input should be increasing into parliament, there's a problem brewing on the horizon. Politicians want the UK's upper house, the House of Lords, to become more democratic, which sounds great until you work out that this could also reduce the number of scientifically trained people in government. The Campaign for Science and Engineering are so worried about it, in fact, that they commissioned a report onto the effects of the proposed reforms. I'm joined by the group's assistant director, Beck Smith. So, Beck, welcome to the programme. Can you just paint a picture for us about how represented science is in the House of Lords at the moment?
There are just over 800 members of the House of Lords at present, and it's actually very hard to quantify exactly how many of those have expertise because, well, it's hard to state exactly what we mean by expertise. Is it just that they have a degree in science and engineering, or is it that they've been on a board of a body that looks at science and engineering issues? But the only thing we do know for sure is that there are a huge amount more in the House of Lords than there are in House of Commons, where there are probably less than five who we can say for sure that they definitely have science and engineering.
We've talked about the paucity of scientific knowledge amongst MPs, members of Parliament in the House of Commons, before. So the House of Lords having former scientists and science people from scientific industry, it's a good sort of counterweight to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the role of the House of Lords is to scrutinise and revise legislation. So we need people who are able to do that, who are able to bring their expertise to bear on that sort of legislation. And there have been a huge number of examples where that sort of expertise has been incredibly influential.
Now, what are the proposed reforms to the House? Because at the moment, all of the Lords are appointed by politicians or the Appointments Committee, which is kind of sort of independent, but not really. And they're there for life. And there's nothing democratic about it, which, you know, for a democratic country seems a bit odd. And there are reforms proposed that would make the whole thing democratic. That sounds pretty good for, you know, a person who wants accountable government. What's your concern about it there?
So I think it's important to say that in lots of the discussion around House of Lords reform, the role of expertise and the presence of expertise in the House of Lords has kind of been pitched against this kind of democratic deficit. Well, and what we really want to do with our report is kind of start the discussion on what is the House of Lords for? What are we trying to do with the House of Lords? Rather than just skipping forward to what it should look like, what form it should take. So if it moves to fully elected, some research has been done by Research Fortnight, where they surveyed just under 40 people who we can define as having expertise and asked them if they'd stand, and only 6 said they would.
Stand for election.
So we know that if we do move to a fully elected House, we're going to lose a huge swathe of people with expertise. That's not to say that we shouldn't do it. It's possible. I mean, Unlock Democracy say that if we move to a fully elected House, then we could bring expertise in through a kind of committee system. We could have standing committees on all sorts of things, and then, you know, we'd be able to bring science and engineering expertise on a kind of ad hoc basis, and perhaps, you know, that might work. We don't know, but none of that discussion is happening at the moment. So we're slightly concerned that we're charging ahead into what it should look like, and we're missing exactly what it's trying to do as the House of Lords.
So give us some examples of the benefits that the Lords can bring. In your report, you give 3. Take us through the first one, admixed embryos. What are these, first of all, and what did the House of Lords do to sort of make sure the legislation went in the correct scientific decision way?
Okay, so admixed embryos are embryos which are 99% human embryo, 1% non-human embryo. What the presence of expertise, in particular Robert Winston, who's obviously a professor of embryology, brought to this was a kind of a thorough experience, and was able to kind of calm some of the fears about this area of expertise, which the UK has been doing some sorts of research in this area prior to this bill. This was really an updating of a bill rather than a brand new one. And what we wanted to make sure is that the UK was able to stay a world leader in this sorts of human reproductive technologies and stem cell research.
So that issue was quite interesting, because what happened was, as you say, it was an update to the Human and Fertilisation and Embryology Act. And the risk was that in the House of Commons, it became a very politicised issue, because these embryos had to be created from discarded human cells, essentially. And the problem was it then got tied up with the whole abortion debate. And there were people in the House of Commons who thought only politically. And by banning this research, which is what they wanted to do, and the House of Commons wanted to do to some extent, you would risk throwing away Britain's lead in this area. Because these, correct me if I'm wrong, but these types of embryos, these admixed embryos, were only going to be used for research. There was never going to be a therapeutic thing.
In a highly regulated framework as
That's
well.
Right. And so the idea was that people didn't understand that was the issue. And I have to say, the scientific community, not only the House of Lords, but the scientific community, did a really good job of sitting down with MPs and explaining to them one by one. And of course, the House of Lords came forward as well as a very important legislative body to say, you know, we as experts can tell you that this is the direction it should go in. And it was taken very seriously. And let's face it, if you're a scientifically minded person, the correct decision was taken and the law was passed. And we can now do that research in the country. Now, whether we need to or want to is another question. But let's go on to another one. The House of Commons, House of Lords rather, has a Science and Technology Committee, which has done extensive reports. And one of the most influential you cite is the report on nuclear research and development capabilities in 2011. What did this do to government policy?
Okay, so the scope of the inquiry wasn't really to take a position for or against nuclear power, but rather to examine what the government was doing and whether it was doing enough to maintain and develop UK nuclear research and its development capabilities. And what the committee did, it brought a huge amount of experts together to a series of committee sessions, and its report highlighted this extraordinary discrepancy between the views of some government officials and independent experts on this issue, and concluded there's a need for kind of fundamental change from the government in its approach to nuclear R&D.
Well, of course, the whole problem with nuclear, of course, was tied up again with a sort of very political, environmental campaigning against it. And then you had on the other side climate change, which is an even bigger issue than any other at the moment in terms of social policy and all sorts of things. So you need a nuclear power. And it would it be fair to say that the House of Lords Select Committee report was influential in making sure that we still have a nuclear strategy for this country?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things it did, it kind of put the issue back on the government's agenda, and it's going to publish, the government is now, as a result of the committee findings, it's going to publish a long-term strategy on the role of nuclear energy to 2050 and beyond, which is a hugely valuable piece of work, which it seems slightly odd that we weren't doing it in the first place.
So in your ideal world then, before the House of Lords reform happens, and it will happen, it sounds like this Parliament or the next, there will be some sort of reform of the House of Lords to make it smaller and more democratically elected. What do you think are the things that need to happen at the end of that? What is the important set of issues that need to be maintained so that scientific expertise doesn't disappear?
I think the first thing we need to do, above everything else, is just consider what we want the House of Lords to be able to do and start from there. So if we think that its function should remain a revising chamber, then let's make sure it's equipped to do that. It doesn't necessarily have to be done by having members in the chamber. We can supplement it with committees, but let's really start to have that discussion first. There are some specific things that we would like. The Appointments Commission, as you mentioned at the beginning, currently has 7 people on it. There's a chair, 3 people who are representatives of the 3 major political parties, and 3 people who are non-party political members. We'd like to see that fully independent, fully non-party political members. And if we are moving to a partly elected upper house, then I do think there's an argument for increasing the proportion, which is going to be appointed to 30%. That would mean that we kind of counterbalance some of the political representation in the chamber, and it gives us an opportunity to have some more expertise represented, some work that was done by the UCL Constitution Unit on trying to understand expertise in the upper house suggested that one of the areas where it's lacking is in environmental protection, which is clearly this huge global policy issue. So it could be more proactive and perhaps seeking experts to represent areas that we clearly would benefit from them being there. Then I think that would be a healthy step forward.
Now, there is a risk that people would see your report and your arguments as special pleading for science. Now, of course, we're broadly supportive of the idea of scientific expertise in government too, but it's really hard to get around the fact that what you're proposing essentially is a scrutiny and check body that is appointed rather than fully democratic. Now, you've answered some of those concerns by saying that, you know, that this is an important function for democracy, in fact. But what about other groups who come along and say, we want representation too? I mean, why is it that science should perhaps be treated differently?
Well, I don't think we're special pleading at all, because expertise is expertise. It can be in science and engineering, it can be in philosophy, it can be in the arts. But we need people with that sort of expertise to act as this kind of checking body in the upper house.
Who otherwise wouldn't take part in politics.
Yeah, and there should be a space for people that don't want to be politicians, but whose presence that we benefit from. So I think that in order to allow that to happen, we do need to have, whether it be in an extended committee system or whether it be in perhaps the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology being a bit more proactive and having, well, one of the things we've asked for is this sort of induction program that they sort of tried last time, but it wasn't compulsory and it had a very...
Tell us what the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology is.
It's exactly what it says. It's the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology. It sits within Parliament, and one of the its most predominant outputs are these things called post notes, which tend to be on, or anything really, radiation, nuclear energy, genetically modified organisms. They kind of produce, I think, my 3 or 4 in a go, and they're kind of 4-page documents that are circulated around Parliament to kind of get members up to speed on
it. And it's an independent body. I mean,
yes.
Politically independent,
yes,
body.
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. So that could be strengthened perhaps as a sort of a research unit, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is the House of Lords and the House of Commons libraries do brilliant research as well. So I think there is scope to kind of bring those together and make sure we're using the best of all of those resources. But one thing they tried last year was this induction program where they wanted to get members to come and find out about, you know, how you use evidence, use of statistics. I mean, there are quite some glaring mistakes that are made from time to time. So if we could get people to understand that, well, one, that the Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology exists and there are all of these other support mechanisms within Parliament that they can use, that would be great. But because it wasn't compulsory, it had a very, very low turnout. So we'd like to see that become a compulsory induction programme for new members, but also open to existing members of both houses.
Beck, thank you very much. To read the report we've just been talking about in full, just go to the Campaign for Science and Engineering website at sciencecampaign.org.uk. Our next guest is a perfect example of how scientific thinking and evidence can benefit social policymaking. Charlotte Watts's background is rooted in high-level abstract mathematics. Her career, though, has moved more towards the social sciences. She's a professor of social and mathematical epidemiology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Her work has focused on the spread of HIV and also violence against women. She's an internationally renowned expert in this field. Charlotte came into the studio to provide an insight into how collecting data could force more countries to think about violence against women as a major public health concern. Charlotte, thank you so much for being here. Your work focuses on domestic violence around That's the right. world. You published a major report in 2006 in The Lancet, which looked at the prevalence of domestic violence. It seems like a very hard thing to measure. You know, it's a very intimate and very sort of private thing that happens. How do you go about doing it? How do you go about systematically measuring it?
You're right. I mean, it's incredibly difficult area to research, and you have to go about it very carefully. I mean, what we have to do for these sorts of surveys is think very carefully, firstly, about how do we get good responses. So work before the study that we published in The Lancet often used quite subjective questions. You know, have you been abused? Have you been a victim of violence? These sorts of questions that, you know, you don't really know how to interpret the responses. So what we did here was ask about very behaviorally explicit questions. Have you been punched? Have you been kicked? Have you had a weapon used against you? So that we can get a much more precise sort of sense of what women's experiences are. But alongside that, we have to think very carefully about how do we actually ask women these sorts of very personal questions in a way that doesn't unduly traumatize them, that doesn't put them at risk from violence if, you know, their partner is violent. So the whole development of the survey methods entailed a lot of attention to making sure that the interviewers had the right skills to be able to ask these questions in a sort of sensitive way and to be able to respond appropriately if a woman did disclose violence. Also to ensure that the woman's partner wasn't present and to have sort of strategies in place for if a partner did interrupt an interview or a child came in or something like that, which could potentially lead to, you know, women being at risk. And then also to develop systems of referral. So if a woman did request assistance, that we could also act upon that. I think the other element related to this research is, I mean, it's such a sort of sensitive but important issue that you can't really go and tick boxes and say, oh, thanks, great, and walk away. You really have to be committed to use these findings to really try and influence policy and to get sort of national governments in the countries that we're working in to sort of have a look at the figures and think about what are the implications for them.
What were the sort of the headline stats for you from that report? I mean, it was the first time someone had done something so systematically on
this
issue.
That's right, yeah. I mean, we did large household surveys in 10 countries, and in total we interviewed about 24,000 women. What we saw was a lot of variation in the levels of violence reported in the different countries, but it was high everywhere. It wasn't like there was any place that where we did the surveys where violence wasn't an issue. But in practice, we had prevalence rates varying from sort of 7-10% up to sort of 60-70% of women saying that they'd been either physically or sexually abused by a partner. And so what that's led to is a lot of analysis, sort of, you know, sort of detailed statistical analyses to say, well, what are the factors that seem to be driving that variation in the levels of violence?
And so this allows you, as you say, to tease apart local variations. And what kinds of interventions then can policymakers start making when you have this sort of data?
Well, I mean, the kinds of issues that come up as being important everywhere and actually very consistently across settings, both where there is high levels of violence and where there are low levels of violence, are things like childhood experiences of violence. If you grow up in a violent household, women are more likely to experience violence as an adult. Similarly for men, if they grow up seeing their father beat their mother, they're more likely to go on and perpetrate violence. Issues around alcohol use, problematic alcohol use, has a very clear link with violence. And also issues around education. So women who have higher levels of education seem to be less vulnerable to experiencing violence. So it's those sorts of findings that we're taking to policymakers.
Now you're a researcher at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. So make the link for me between violence against women and public health. I mean, it seems obvious, but make that explicit to me.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting, actually, because for some people it seems obvious that it's a link with other health, and so for some people they go, why are you looking at this? And you know, you work on health. I mean, the way I think about the issue of domestic violence is it's a bit like it's really a hidden risk factor for a huge range of poor health outcomes for women. So we see strong links, for example, between experiencing violence and things like depression, suicide. There's the direct impacts of violence, so things like homicide. Women are murdered around the world by their partners each year. We're also starting to get evidence about the links with HIV, and so women who are in violent relationships in South Africa or sort of other settings where HIV is highly prevalent are at increased risk of acquiring HIV. And so it's a large focus of the work that I do is trying to understand those links and really sort of help take the issue of violence to the health sector and to the sort of public health community and say, look, this is something like smoking was maybe 10, 15 years ago. It's an issue that is important for people's health, but actually we aren't thinking about it in health terms and we aren't doing interventions that try and support women who are experiencing the health impacts of being in a violent relationship.
Is it the abuse itself which is the risk factor for disease and health problems, or is it more that the people who are more at risk of abuse and violence are living in an environment where these sorts of things are more prevalent in some way?
That's a very good question. So the kinds of analyses that we do to try and tease out that question will often be setting specific. So we'll say if we look at women, for example, in South Africa, and are they more at risk of HIV? All of those women are in a setting where there's a lot of HIV, but we'll have some women who don't have an experience of violence and some who do, and we'll compare the likelihood that they have HIV and control for some other potentially confounding variables to come up with a sort of an unbiased measure. It is quite detailed and careful epidemiological analyses that we're doing in the end to try and understand that link and what's causing that link.
And we talked about interventions before. I mean, this stuff helps you to understand the problems, and therefore you can design, and the World Health Organization and others can design interventions, education, as you mentioned. Have any of them been shown to work? It's been a short amount of time, but have any of them been shown to work at reducing violence?
I mean, and that's actually a large area of work that I'm involved in with my team here at the school and with partners around the world. And so what we're doing in three countries at the moment are studies to try and measure the impact of different interventions that are trying to prevent intimate partner violence. And so what we're doing is basically adapting the kind of research methods that traditionally were developed to see if a drug works, to test whether community-focused interventions actually impact on violence.
Clinical trials of interventions
in communities,
that's interesting.
So we call them cluster randomized controlled trials, and actually there's a lot of work at the school that goes on around how do we use these methods to evaluate the impact of community-focused interventions.
Sense to me, given that your school is the one that does public trials most effectively around the world.
Exactly.
So it completely makes sense.
And so we did a trial, for example, a few years ago in rural South Africa, where we looked at the impact of economically and socially empowering poor rural women. And what we showed that was over 2 years, we more than halved the levels of violence that women had experienced. So, I mean, that was a very powerful study because it demonstrated very clearly that actually this is an issue that not only is common, it has a huge impact, health impact, but also we can actually prevent violence over quite relatively short time frames. And so that's the other body of real work that we're really trying to pursue in the next few years.
Now, you're a mathematician by training.
Yes.
Having heard all your words so far, it should be clear why this is exactly the right area for you. But how did you get into the specific area? I mean, you wouldn't expect a mathematician who's maybe interested in abstract concepts and, you know, numbers and algebra to get into such a social and important issue like this?
It's a good question. I can't say there's a nice, tidy logic to it. But, my PhD was actually in chaos theory. And so it was a theoretical PhD looking at mathematical functions from one infinite dimensional space to another infinite dimensional space. So after that, I thought I really need to do something applied. So I started doing modeling of HIV and got some funding to do some field work in Zimbabwe. And whilst I was there, I was studying HIV. So you're having conversations about quite intimate and personal issues, and the issue of violence just kept on coming up. And I just got more and more intrigued about, well, what are the sort of social issues behind the numbers that as a mathematician I'm trying to model through? And so that really sort of started the way, it sort of started a path of trying to do this kind of quantitative survey research to really try and unpack, well, what are the numbers behind things like women's vulnerability to HIV and how do we understand that more? And then how do we design and test interventions to actually do something about it.
I mean, before you came along with these sorts of techniques, there must have been many, many groups trying to tackle these sorts of issues around the world. And how do they respond to these sorts of more quantitative methods? Are they positive about them? Do they think that this is a good direction to travel in?
I think on the whole, yes. I mean, I think if you're somebody who's been working in the field of violence for a long time, and then you see the sort of approaches that we're using in a survey, they are quite reductionist. We're asking a small set of questions to women about their experiences of violence. And that's very, it is quite simplistic. The sort of phenomena of violence is much more complex than what we capture in a quantitative sort of fairly closed, using quite closed questions. But at the same time, I think we've been quite careful to try and acknowledge that limitation because, but also to recognize the power of actually getting figures from a representative sample of a population. It really tells you what's going on in a different way than maybe a narrative from a woman who've experienced violence. You know, it just gives you a different piece of the puzzle about what's really going on and what might be the interventions that can be effective. I mean, in terms of the intervention models, what we're really keen on doing is trying to say, well, what are really promising interventions that NGOs and different organizations around the world have been implementing for a while? And actually, can we bring our research expertise to that and work with them to try and evaluate the impact of their programs? And so that process is often quite long and it's very, very rich, where we're really trying to do our best to really capture what that intervention is about in the way that we're trying to look at its impact. And so often we have researchers who are sort of full-time living and breathing the program and then trying to design the research tools that actually do justice to what the intervention is doing.
So I'm intrigued about the quantitative nature of this. You mentioned already that it's slightly reductionist, and you can imagine that people who have seen these things in the field a lot might think, well, you know, you can't reduce people to numbers, but what is the motivation you have to keep going with it?
I mean, I think that the way I think about this is, yeah, it is reductionist, but actually I want to collect data and evidence that I can take to the Minister of Finance, I can take to the Minister of Health, senior people in planning departments who don't care about this issue, but actually give them quantitative evidence that they find very hard to ignore. And so, I mean, a big focus of the kind of intervention work we do is to tell the human story, because it is, you know, a powerful story, to give them hard evidence about the impact of the intervention, to tell them what it costs, and to show that actually this is cost effective if we compare it with other programs that they're already funding, and also to give some evidence of actually it's something that we can scale up. So these aren't little sort of boutique projects. These are things that we could actually potentially do on a large scale, because that's what we need to do to really have a big impact on these sorts of issues.
So you can tell the finance minister and the healthcare minister of a country that here's the data around violence in your country. If you were to spend X amount of money doing these interventions that we've proven have worked, then your healthcare burden goes down. I mean, that sounds like the wrong way to look at it, but in a way, that's what they listen to, right?
Yeah, that is the overall aim. We haven't quite added it up to this is what you do at a national level.
For you, yeah.
You're dreaming for me. That's my long-term research agenda. But we're basically piecing together the pieces. So, I mean, for example, on that project in South Africa, we showed that it had an impact. We are now scaling it up, so we're now reaching about 15,000 women with the intervention. We've done detailed costings to show actually this is very cheap, and actually as you go to a bigger scale, it's getting cheaper. And then we've done a cost-effectiveness analysis to say actually this is affordable, kind of using the criteria that countries use to say, is this a good buy or not?
Are these methods of yours also important in the sort of the increasing ability, the increasing desire for governments to be open about their data sets and provide people with tools to analyze them?
Yeah, I mean, I think the sort of openness of data set is really useful. We always have a challenge when we get to some, when we try and look at some of the kind of more routine data sets. So things like how many cases go to the police, because it gives you a sense of how many cases go to the police, but it's a bit of the tip of the iceberg because most women will never go to the police. So for some of those sort of routine figures, they're useful and sometimes they aren't. But what we're finding very useful is increasingly in a range of different developing countries, there are large national surveys being implemented by governments to understand the extent of a whole range of health problems. And increasingly those surveys are incorporating questions on women's experiences of violence. And so we're really using them a lot to try and understand more generally, how much violence is there, what are the health impacts, what are the risk factors, and also feed it into this big global burden sort of prevalence work that we're doing and we'll be launching later this year.
Charlotte, thank you very much.
Not at all.
Many thanks there to Professor Charlotte Watts. For links to her work, just go to the Science Weekly blog. That's it until next week. Remember, for breaking science news at any time, go to guardian.co.uk/science. Until next time, from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.